Good afternoon. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Now, today, we are talking with three Northwest Iowa legislators about the tumultuous legislative session that just ended. With me are three representatives, one Republican representative from Sioux City, Jim Carlin, who just ended his first legislative session. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Also, Tim Cassina, this is your first one as well, Democrat from Sioux City.
Thank you.
And State Senator David Johnson of Ochiden. Now, David, for a long time, you were a Republican.
Until last June.
Why don't you tell us a little bit of sort of why you changed?
Well, I just felt that the two-party system was not working anymore because it was driving the two parties into extremes. Certainly, the presidential race was of great concern to me. I believe that Mr. Trump is not qualified to be president of the United States. I continue to do that. He's the leader of the Republican Party, and I'll just make it short and sweet. I am not going to be a member of a party who has Donald Trump as their leader.
So that was your main reason.
Well, there was other. I probably would have with this Republican agenda that was unveiled, that was really not part of the campaigns that I ever detected in the Senate, was not really laid out there. I don't know of a single candidate who ran on allowing guns in the Capitol, for example. You know, what's that all about? And I probably would have changed my party affiliation and said, I'm going to continue on as a no-party senator.
So it was definitely part of it, but there you had other
right.
reasons
and
as
I've
well.
Recently attended a conference in Kansas City where groups that are loosely connected are looking to elect more independents, that maybe we can have more effective legislation that way with independents. An interesting concept that I've heard or at least idea is if there were a handful of independents elected to the United States Senate, you would have an independent as the leader of the Senate. Because it wouldn't be the Republicans or the Democrats being able to elect a leader. They'd have to go to the independents, small group of independents, in order to find somebody to work with. So, I mean, there are people who want another choice. And my core values haven't changed much. Right. It's just that I'm not going to be a member of a party who has the current president as a leader.
Ooh. Well, I know that the big Republican sweep across the nation and in the state played a big factor this year in the legislature. Tim Cassina, were you at all, I know this is your first year, but were you at all surprised at how divisive things became?
I suppose a bit, but having never been there before, this is normal to me. Okay, so I didn't go in and have any history of this is the way it was or it wasn't. So when
right.
I got down there, I just took it as the way I would anything else. You know, you learn as you go and you see what truly is there. And
right.
that's what I saw down there. And what I saw was a divisiveness, a polarization among the parties. And that's what we're working under. Those are the rules that we have right now, unfortunately.
Mm. Jim, what about you?
To be honest, I expected the divisiveness. But over the course of being down in Des Moines, I have found that there's quite a few Democrats that are very good to work with and, you know, build relationships with and share some core values and some ideas that we mutually think have a place in legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it I was pleasantly surprised
mm-hmm.
to encounter.
There were a lot of issues that were really party line issues this year. One of them had to do with voter ID, requiring voters to show an ID when they vote. People came out and spoke about it at length at one of the many public hearings. I believe there were up four in 2 days or 3 days, which is very unusual. Now, Jim, I believe you supported this voter ID legislation.
I did because I think the integrity of the process demands validation and identity of voters at the polls. I don't think that's unreasonable. I think the cost of ensuring that was pretty nominal to ensure the integrity of the process, and that's why I voted for it.
Mm. Now, Tim, you were against this, weren't you?
Oh, without question. This had nothing to do with voter ID. This has everything to do with voter suppression. If it was only ID, we wouldn't have cut back the amount of days that you had to vote.
Early voting?
Yes.
Right.
And there was
that.
No reason for that whatsoever. You know, and all the other hurdles that they put up, as far as the absentee voting, the other. Basically, if you would have taken an ALEC bill of what they suggest on voter ID and compared it to Iowa, this is what you have. It was an outside interest that came in to take care of this.
David?
Well, I would agree with that. And he's talking about the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I was a member, but I am no longer a member of that group. But just for the interest of full disclosure, there was a time when I tried to listen to these think tanks and came to a different conclusion. We don't have a problem with integrity of our voter system. I mean, we're talking about a dozen at most question ballots, and we're going to spend $1 million to try to fix a problem that doesn't exist. There's no reason for it. And I think that there's definitely a racial factor at work here. I see that all across the country with some of the legislation that's being proposed. I know that there's a big sweep here by the Republicans, but I didn't see any reason that we had to do this other than maybe it polls well. It does poll well, you know, with voters. But what's the problem? We have really good integrity the way it is now. And I think it's a way for the Secretary of State to pretty much cement his position in there and make that office, give reason for that office. I don't really understand it, but no, I voted no. And I'm really concerned about not only the political divisiveness, but also the racial divisiveness that we have just can't get ourselves over.
Jim, do you think that there's, I know that this was something that a lot of Republicans answered to during the debate about voter suppression and the racial side of this. Do you think there's any merit in these arguments?
I don't. You know, Tim made reference to the number of days for absentee ballots. I believe that was reduced from 45 to 29. In reality, I don't think that would have any significant impact on access to the polls. It's still one of the largest, or you know, number of days nationally by comparison. You know, to say that being required to have a picture ID is too great a burden when the state is going to be mailing out voter IDs to anybody who requests one, or if you have a driver's license, or if you know, if you just want to cash a check or be able to receive government benefits on any level, anything to do with the government on some level where you're voting or applying for Social Security or anything else, there should be some means of authenticating identity in that process.
Mm-hmm. I was a little unsure about the final cost after talking to a few different people involved with this bill, what the cost would be for the local, you know, counties. I didn't know, would they have to have new equipment? Who would pay for that equipment? And there seemed to be a couple different versions of that.
I don't know that there would be any necessity of new equipment.
Because I wasn't
potentially
quite sure.
some computer software monitoring, but I think the cost would be pretty reasonable.
I know they were talking about getting some kind of funding to, you know, offset the cost to the counties, but so in the end, I guess a lot of the issue was though about whether or not it would disenfranchise some voters, and you know, in the end, it was sort of a party line split on that. I don't know of any that voted outside the party.
Well, one of the things is we're not just, you know, it's been made out to be racial, but, you know, there have been instances of voter fraud on both sides of the aisle where Republicans have voted multiple times, Democrats have voted multiple times. This will be a way of authenticating who and who has not voted. And again, that lends itself to the integrity of the process.
You know, so. Tim, you're kind of shaking your head there. I see you.
Basically, there's more people killed in this country by TVs falling off their shelves and hitting them than there are voter fraud in this country. Okay, so we know that's a
Do we have any statistics on that?
That is just garbage.
I haven't read any TV falling statistics.
But the fact is that no, if you just look at Wisconsin and what they did, first time Donald Trump ever won a Democrat ever won Wisconsin. He won by 12,000 votes. There were 300,000 people that were disenfranchised by that law up there.
Really?
Yeah, this will be the same thing that'll happen here. Yes. In Iowa, we looked at disenfranchised 200,000 voters in this state from this. And not only that, as far as the equipment goes, we had the money to do that.
Okay.
But we spent that money on the last voter fraud chase, trying to find it at that time. Right now, we're running Windows 95 on a lot of our election equipment here. It is time to upgrade it.
And I can't believe that's even running, if it's Windows 95.
Honestly, I believe that's what a lot of them are.
Wow.
Okay. So we did have, and if we're going to put this money into something, it should be to make sure that our e-polls are up to date, to make sure that we have a good system in place and use our dollars wisely when it comes to voting.
If I recall, I'll just add a one footnote. There was only one registered lobbyist group that was in favor of this law, and that was the Iowa Minutemen Civil Defense Corps. Now, who are they?
I don't know.
Nobody else registered for this in favor of, not the counties, not the auditors, association. No one was in favor of this from the perspective of those who monitor this legislation and register for it. I found that very, very interesting.
Today we're talking about some of the issues in the legislative session. And another big issue had to do, and went on at some length, the collective bargaining bill. And that was one of the areas where belts were being tightened, because in part of the deficits in the budget and the projected deficits in the budget that looks like they're going to continue at least for the next fiscal year. I would just like to ask, so there were a lot of comments made during the session about the reason for these deficits. Some of the Democrats specifically were saying they had to do with too many tax incentives and tax credits given out by the state that the governor was spearheading, and that that the revenues did not reflect, it really didn't help out the state. In fact, we have revenue deficits now. I'd just like to ask each of you, what do you think the problem was behind these budget deficits? I'll start with you, David.
We all have been complicit over the years, I believe. This is my 19th year there in how we've handled the tax incentives and the credits, and not really taking them into account. It was the Democrats, I would observe, who proposed a permanent committee to annually review those credits and their impact on the budget, because a credit is spending. I mean, if you're going to provide a credit to a business or a nonprofit organization, or for any reason to a family on their tax forms, it is a matter of spending. So, but they can accumulate, and all of a sudden you're finding that not has your tax base hasn't expanded, it's actually contracted, and that's what seems to have happened here. And it is a matter of the softening of the agricultural economy somewhat, but I think too much emphasis has been put on that. It's a poor economy. We have low wages in this state, and that doesn't help the situation either. I mean, we had the big $4 billion tax cut here over a 10-year period a few years ago. I think it was 2013 that we enacted that on a bipartisan basis. It isn't working. Like most big tax cuts, like the one they're talking about in Washington, it's not going to result in more jobs. It's not going to result in doing away with some of our huge federal deficit. And it's just a slowdown. We're growing, but we're not growing by as much. So we have to do a hard look at what we're doing there, where our priorities are.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, you know, one of the things that came up was our REC estimates were down $117 million and another $131 million. And I think the reality of that had a lot to do with the economy overall, but I think primarily it had to do with the ag economy and the numbers being down in ag. And I think that wasn't something that could have been anticipated by, you know, by the REC, and we had to contend with that, and you know, I don't think you can reasonably blame the tax credits on the deficit. The tax credits are something that, particularly in border cities like Sioux City, we need targeted jobs to be competitive, to encourage businesses to come here.
So we need those tax incentives.
We do. We need to have some tax credits. I agree with David. I think we do need to monitor and assess how well they're performing to see if they're working or they what are they bringing to the table for Iowa. The overall reason that we are in the situation we're in is, I think, more has to do with economy than too much spending.
Mm-hmm. Tim, what do you think? Do you think that the tax incentives were at the heart of this?
All I know for sure is that we had $930 million in surplus, and now we're $130 million in the hole. Mm. And $500 million of that is driven by, you know, by out-of-state or by corporate tax rates, which many of them are out of state. So, of course, it's going to make a difference on it. And like David said, you know, this trickle-down economics, they don't work. They haven't worked anywhere that I've seen them. They've been trying this since 1972 in the southern cone of South America. The policies don't work on trickle-down. We need a good economic model that will maybe breed a little Friedman and Keys at the same time and find that one that works. But
you know, find that good spot.
That good spot in between the two. But if you go party, you're only going to go this way or you go that way. But I do believe that there is room to find a good economic model that'll work for our state.
Yeah, of course, in Nebraska, they're trying to write a budget right now. They have some of the same issues.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just Iowa. It's many states are in this situation.
But, I mean, all we have to do is look at all we've lost to South Dakota to know that money migrates to the friendliest tax climates. Our white-collar professionals, our contractors, we've seen them go over to the dunes, and we've lost all those tax dollars because we're not competitive. And that's the money is going to migrate to the friendlier pastures. And we have a business climate that ranks 41st nationally, and that's largely due to an ineffective, onerous tax policy that has the second highest corporate tax rate in the country and the fifth highest personal income tax rate in the country. And that discourages businesses from coming here and encourages people to leave.
Mm. Well, speaking of business issues, the governor went ahead and signed a bill that was passed that gives the state final say over minimum wages, minimum wage setting, and several counties in Iowa had already decided to raise their minimum wages, mm-hmm. and now that's been preempted. Mm-hmm. A lot of Democrats felt that this was unfair, especially to working people. Businesses felt like they wanted to have a uniform minimum wage that would be the same in all counties, though. David, what was your opinion about this?
There's a reason that those localities, those counties and cities were passing those things. I think it was to send a clear signal to the legislature, you know, it's time to raise the minimum wage after being unchanged in 10 years, and look what our other states are doing.
The minimum wage is pretty low in Iowa.
We're at the bottom of the Upper Mississippi River. Only Wisconsin has a $7.25 per hour minimum wage. Minnesota, now my five counties are up in the upper corner, so I'm going to put Minnesota in there because I'm right up against the border. They're at $9.50 an hour. South Dakota's at $8.65. Nebraska's at $9 an hour, and we're sitting down at $7.25 an hour.
So again, it's competition.
It's competition for low-wage jobs.
Right.
I mean, we've got to pay people more, and it'll change the entire pay structure in this state. And I think it was wrong to take away that local control. But what I didn't understand is that when the majority party in the Senate wanted to talk about local control, they talked about local control, and it was like the Bible. You know, we have to have local control, except when they want state control. The overall picture that I get from this session is nothing but state control all the way down on most of the major issues that we dealt with. It's state control. They weren't saying that, you know, one of the principles that I was always taught as a Republican who grew up as a Republican and who has been a Republican and still has some of those core values is the best government is the government closest to you. You know, they know their situations in Johnson County and in Linn County and Polk County. They should know whether or not they need to have a higher minimum wage. Or take Lee County. Now, Lee County was moving in that direction.
Right.
The highest unemployment that any county in the state over the last decades. And that's one reason that new fertilizer plant was located there. But let's not even go there because we gave them so much money in tax incentives. Let me just bring that up, is that they're going to have 220 permanent jobs. Chasing those jobs costs $550,000 per job. In incentives to based abroad, but a company that is getting millions, tens of millions of dollars in tax credits for a large fertilizer plant. Now, I don't know if CF Industries is exactly what they got here, but we're having these. But just remember, they keep talking about lots of jobs, but many of them are construction jobs. But getting back to that. That whole thing with local control. This was a session about the state pushing back on anything that didn't suit the Republican agenda.
What do you think about that? The whole local control issue.
Well, let's talk about minimum wage for a minute.
Okay.
I backed that particular bill that gave a statewide minimum wage primarily because if you have one county bidding against another and those counties are literally next door to each other, that's going to create some unforeseen, unintended consequences that I don't think would be good. Having said that, I do think that the minimum wage should reflect the cost of living for the last 10 years. I think it should be increased. Again, in accordance with what the consumer price index for those years.
Well, I think
reflects.
The governor agrees with you on that there needs to be some increase.
Yeah. And I actually wanted to see that happen at the same time, and hopefully we will see that next year in session. On the collective bargaining front, one of the big problems that local school districts had to contend with was the inequities of contract negotiation with specifically with teacher unions, where the arbitration process lent itself to a statewide mean. When you have one negotiating body negotiating all the contracts across the state, and then you have a local school district on the other side of the table, and if it's unresolved, it just goes to the statewide mean, then that creates a pretty big disparity in terms of the relative bargaining, negotiating power that's in play. So school districts, in effect, had no real authority. And that was out of balance. And what we have now, I guess we're going to have to see how it all plays out. I've been assured by, some superintendents around the state that they think that the teachers will have their, they'll have their contracts negotiated, and the sky really is not going to fall, despite what's been represented at a lot of these forums. And I think once that becomes evident, we'll know the realities of what happened with collective bargaining. I think most of these things don't reach the level of arbitration, and if they don't reach the level of arbitration, then, the unions are free to bargain the way they normally would.
Hmm. Well, I know that up in Wisconsin, I talked to a reporter up there who discussed some of the issues with teachers after a similar law went down there about 5 years ago, I believe, that they did basically the same thing with collective bargaining for public employees. And he said that, a lot of teachers in some rural areas did leave, and they did have a hard time getting teachers. Often it was with veteran teachers who kind of had issues with this because they were used to a different way of doing business. Sometimes younger teachers were more amenable to this new system because they really didn't know anything else. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you had increased competitiveness. On the other hand, you had some school districts who were having a hard time finding any teachers. So, and Tim, I know you were very much against this particular collective bargaining bill. I think, like a lot of Democrats, you said there's nothing wrong with looking at how collective bargaining is done, but this seemed to be a wholesale sort of wiping out of the power of collective bargaining.
That's exactly what it did. I think if you look at, well, let's just look at the latest offer Western Iowa Tech put out to its employees here. And you see where they took away every permissible part that was in collective bargaining before. Listen, there was a problem with a couple parts of collective bargaining that we could have addressed. One would have been the high cost of insurance that we could have put a cap on. The other would have been the arbitration process of whether we needed a fact-finding in there or a change within that area to make collective bargaining work. Collective bargaining has worked since 1974. There was nothing wrong with collective bargaining, but once again, this is an outside, far from the middle organization that pushes these changes as they're pushing them across the country. This is not Iowans making this. Unfortunately, there are Iowans voting for this and falling for these traps, but it is not needed. We could have fixed collective bargaining very easily, and people still would have had their voice at their workplace. At this point, with no voice, at what time does that become servitude? I'm not sure.
David?
It's become an excuse to go elsewhere. That's what's happened in Wisconsin. You can go to Minnesota, start for nearly $4,000 a year. You can make up to $70,000 a year. They are actively recruiting Iowa teachers because this is nothing but pushing down the cost of paying a teacher what a teacher is due. This is one of the hardest and most important lines of work that we have in this state. Education is the best economic development tool that we have. If you don't have a good education, and we know it depends on good teachers and a good teaching environment, you're just not going to get that. And the fact of the matter is, facts always get in the way, it seems. But fact of the matter is, since 1974, 98% of the contracts that were negotiated locally never went to arbitration. I talked to one negotiator in a school who had been a negotiator there for 20 years and an experienced teacher himself. And they had never gotten into an argument. There was never a shouting match. They sat down. They worked it out, and they always came in lower than the average increase statewide. So what I found hilarious, quite frankly, was the argument of those in favor of this that they got to put the taxpayer at the table. So if I hear about a negotiation next time, then I'm home. I'm going to go to where the opening offers are made before they go into closed session. I think I'll show up and say, I want to know who's here for the taxpayer. Well, of course, the people who are there for the taxpayer is the school board, and the school board hires a superintendent. I mean, the taxpayer is there, and I just don't understand these arguments that were being made because they were false arguments. The thing is, the Wisconsin experience is that 40 their union membership statewide across all public employees is down 40%.
Yeah, it definitely was gutted.
Yeah, it's right. Gutted. And it's the same thing's going to have here. Now, I still consider myself a conservative, but this is no way to treat people. You don't treat people by coming in and taking what took 2 years to build in a Republican legislature with a Republican governor, Bob Ray, who's one of my heroes. And they did that, but they dismantled it in less than 2 weeks with very little chance for Iowans to understand what was going on. And so I really don't believe that it's the absolute core of the anti-worker legislation that went through went through Des Moines this year. And it's no minimum wage, collective bargaining, workers' compensation. We didn't need to change that.
There was that bill too.
You know, I mean, it's just like it was just a whole thing.
And it went through very quickly.
Yes,
All of these happened pretty quickly. I think that was another complaint. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. I'm talking with three Northwest Iowa legislators about the session that just concluded last week. Republican Jim Carlin of Sioux City, Democrat Tim Cassina, also of Sioux City, and Independent State Senator David Johnson of Ocheden. You know, I wanted to get to this whole gun rights bill that passed not too long ago. It extends the sort of stand your ground rights for people with guns, and also allows for concealed carry, I believe, at the state capitol. And this was, and also allows children to use guns with the supervision of their parents. This bill had so much debate, and people on both sides very upset about it, its passage or not passage. It did pass in the end. So I'd like to just go around and ask each of you what you think about it. Why don't I start with Jim? What was your stance on this bill?
I voted for the bill. I voted for it primarily because of the stand your ground provision, which just takes the castle doctrine outside of your home. You're allowed to defend yourself, which I think is reasonable. You know, in Iowa, parents have been teaching kids how to use guns and rifles for years. I didn't see anything particularly egregious about that. I am a little concerned about guns being brought into the Capitol. That isn't necessarily a provision I would have been in favor of. There were some provisions in it that I didn't think I necessarily bought into 100%. But at the end of the day, as a whole, that's why I voted for it.
Mm-hmm. Tim, I know you were not in favor of this. I mean, you were a firefighter for many years, a first responder for many years. From that point of view, how did you see this?
You know, the first time I voted no on this bill. Excuse me. There was just some parts of it that I just didn't like. And if they made some changes, then I probably would have voted for it, which I did second time around. I did support this bill. There were still plenty of parts of it that I did not like.
Okay.
But I also understand that a lot of people feel very strongly about their Second Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
The one that probably changed my mind more than anything else was the fact that they took away the ability when someone sued the city or county that they would have had to pick up that bill. They would have had to pay the court costs for that.
Okay.
And they took that provision out of here. But I think it's very important to understand that you always had stand your ground under 703.
It existed already
there,
right.
Under 703. Stand your ground is a political hype to get people fired up for the Second Amendment rights.
Yeah, really. Well, you noticed at some of those meetings at the museum, people were very upset about this.
Yes.
But I think it was good that they got to air their views and got to discuss some of the issues here. I think that was really helpful because a lot of people thought that this was a new thing, but it wasn't a new thing in Iowa, was it?
No, it never was. No, under Chapter 703, you have basically everything you had under Stand Your Ground, with the exception of someone stealing your bicycle, possibly, and you can shoot them at that point, if I'm not mistaken, Dave.
David?
Probably. I think I'll choose to run after them rather than shoot them. And I am a gun owner, and I do have a concealed weapons permit, but I've never carried in the Capitol. I offered an amendment in the Senate to strike that portion of the bill that allows any concealed weapons permit holder to bring a gun into the Capitol. I also, in that amendment, took away the preemption section where you can continue local jurisdictions like the county, the county courthouse, city hall can be off limits to firearms, but you are also subject to lawsuit in that case. And if somebody can prove, and I'm sure that's going to happen, somebody's going to file a lawsuit against a so-called gun-free zone, that the rights are being impinged or taken away or abridged, I guess that's the word in the Constitution, that, you know, and that failed. And that failed along party lines. And that was my my red line, so to speak, was whether that was in there or not. I signed on to the Stand Your Ground bill by itself at the beginning of the session, right at the first week of the session, because Senator Bertrand was carrying that.
Okay.
And I signed on to that. But look what it became over in the House. In the House, they added all these things to it. They added all these things to it. That's not what I signed on to. And I know there's going to be pushback from Second Amendment advocates, and I am one too, but I don't see any reason to have in the Capitol. things are tough in there. Things are tough in the city halls. You know, in fact, if I can just say this real quickly, no sooner was the ink dry on the governor's signature on that bill that a man walked into the Polk County Courthouse with a gun and with a complaint against the Department of Human Services. And there was a court hearing going on. I believe it was about a child custody case. Those things get very, very ugly fast.
Yes.
And so the security, what kind of security are these courthouses that have multiple courtrooms going to have, like here? And I know that right. Sheriff Drew was against this.
Yeah, he was strongly against this. He likes gun rights, but yeah, he was concerned
that's right,
about
that's
that.
Right. I am very concerned about it. So I think it was the wrong way to go. It was just way too expansive. And I'm understanding that there's going to be more. And then maybe this is a good place. I want to make sure that that's said. That today is that the same cast of characters comes back next year. This is a 2-year General Assembly. We don't have an election until November of 2018. And what I'm hearing is that they've got lots of unfinished business to do. But I'll defer to the Republican here. I would maybe Jim can tell us about that.
Jim, what about the unfinished business?
I think the unfinished business is a path towards tax reform. And I think school choice is going to be on the table.
Well, yeah, that too.
But it's going to depend largely on the economic realities that we're facing with next year. Where we are economically is going to have a lot to do with what choices we're able to make on tax reform and school choice. And mm-hmm. if the economic realities aren't there, then obviously we're going to have to tailor back what we might otherwise do.
Well, it looks like we'll have the same kind of governor. Lieutenant Governor Reynolds will probably be governor mm-hmm. at that time. Governor Branstad will go off to China, most likely. Mm-hmm. So it will be pretty much the same scenario in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. we would assume.
I would think so. There's some legislation that I would like to see go through that I hope has some impetus to get through on senior property tax reform for
yes.
seniors on a fixed income.
So what happened with that? That was a really good idea to bring up and to talk about.
Sure. Well, just in Morningside, and I'm sure around the city, we saw our valuations go up 21% in the last 2 years. And if that much extra revenue is coming in, I guess, you know, we should be having the discussion about how, you know, those increased property taxes are disproportionately hurting fixed income seniors and people on disabilities. And whether that's done at a local or state level, I think it really needs to be looked at when, you know, you're seeing valuations go up 21% in 2 years.
They were pretty high. People said, well, gee, we hadn't brought them up for a long time and we're catching up. Mm-hmm. But it's a big hit for a lot of people. And, you know, someone said, well, gee, I wish I could just sell my house for that amount. Can you guarantee me I can sell my house for that? It's like, no, not really. So, yeah, I was surprised, too. And I live in an area on Jackson Street where they had gone up probably the highest. So I had to talk to some of my neighbors, and I thought, well, it's not just me.
No, it isn't, and it ends up being a pretty decent chunk of money.
Yeah,
right. I don't believe you're talking about a freeze, just a freeze.
Just a freeze.
But if you have to roll it back, but you freeze it right there, so that they are going to be paying property taxes. But and this has been all around a long time, and I still don't understand how we've neglected to bring this to back up again and give it some real analysis as to exactly what the cost of that would be, because there will be a cost to it. But it's important to remember those people and what they're facing, and they shouldn't be forced out of a home that they've come to know and love, so to speak. I mean, none of us would like to see us forced out under those conditions.
Yes, yeah, I agree. You know, next session, do all of you think there will be more talk about social issues? Like this session, they had the 20-week, pardon me, the bill that would ban most abortions after 20 weeks. There were bills also that had to do with, also defunding Planned Parenthood, the state defunding Planned Parenthood, causing a lot of consternation among some groups of women about getting women's health care, how the state will pay for that to create some other services to provide those services that will be, pardon me, lost. It just seems like there's still a lot of unfinished business in this area, and this is always going to be controversial.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I know one thing that we have to do is quit leaving federal dollars on the table. I think this last session we left around $60 million on the table just from policy changes that we made and the cuts that we made that would not match up to it. So if we're going to make cuts, we have to make smart cuts.
Right.
And make sure that we don't lose those dollars coming in just on ideology.
Well, one of those that came very close to that was the Iowa Flood Center.
Yes.
And I believe that some people just believe that that's an Iowa City idea or something. It's not.
It isn't.
Or not Cedar Rapids. It serves the entire state.
It does.
And there was $96 million of federal money and other money that was available if we would just invest $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. And I think we went to $1.2 million on that and saved that. And that's for the entire state. And that's part of our whole water quality. The biggest failure this session was not to do anything about water quality. And to again ignore the wishes of the people in 2010 that they want to fund a trust. And it's in the state constitution. They put it there in a big way. So, and that's my number one issue. At least we got a vote on it. I was able to get a vote on it, but it was defeated. But that's important. But the other thing that we did this year is it's all about industrial agriculture right now. Mm. That it's in the industrial agriculture has a huge advantage. The Aldo Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture was shuttered, just absolutely closed down at Iowa State, unless Iowa State can find a way to save that.
Yeah.
That was a different approach to agriculture. Mm-hmm. But with conservation and alternative crops and other ways to bring smaller operations into being able to make a living doing things like that.
I think
that.
There was also some concern about funding that goes to that sort of research area down in Story County where they're doing innovative things with growing algae to mm-hmm. fight pollution in the water.
Right.
And they're doing some really great things, and it's just been hard for them to sustain funding.
So that money that was going to the Leopold Center is now going to the Iowa Nutrient Research Center.
Okay.
And that's tied into the nutrient reduction strategy.
Okay.
And it's all this industrial approach to cleaning up our waters or in farming. And it's just not, it's a shell game, and it's moving money from one place to another and doesn't do any good.
That's a question I had too, because it seems like things will get defunded and then they'll come back and find some money and shift some money over to where it was taken. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a robbing Peter to pay Paul sort of thing. And in the long run, does that work?
I think that's just the reality. That's just the nature of it. Depending on which party is in control or
right.
if both parties are in control, that's just part of the process. But when you'd mentioned, if I could just speak to the defunding of Planned Parenthood.
Okay, yes.
You know, it got to be that way when, first of all, I believe in life at conception. And I've said that. And I think anytime you go down a path where you're deciding who is and who's not a human being, historically, we've always lost our way, whether it was racism or sexism or, you know, judging somebody based on what their faith was. And now we're, you know, judging the value and dignity of a human being based on where they are gestationally. I just don't think it's the right course to take. And I certainly don't believe in taxpayers subsidizing it. But Planned Parenthood engaged in some pretty egregious activity where they were selling human body parts. And Once you get to a place like that, then you really, I mean, how bad does it have to get before people wake up and recognize the reality of what's going on there? And
Tim, did you want to say something?
On this, I'm just curious where we get the selling of the body parts. I know that there was a video out there and it was defunct, basically, or debunked all the way through and showed that it was false on there. Listen, Planned Parenthood, first of all, no taxpayer dollars went to any abortions. We know that, okay? Planned Parenthood, 97% of the services they provide are for women's health and girls' health. This is a big hit to the low income, those who can't afford the health care that they need at this time, and it was an ideological move, and that's all it was at that point. To not be able to let Planned Parenthood take in the Medicaid dollars that they needed will have devastating effects across this country. I mean, you're not going to be able to go on the dentist office and get your pap smear, which are some of the offices that they have listed there to take care of this. It's not going to happen. And to me, I thought it was a very bad move to do so, because what you're doing is hurting women and their health. And not only that, you're making a choice for a woman that is hers.
I don't know where Tim got his facts from. It's unequivocally been shown that taxpayer dollars do go towards the cost of abortion. That's something that is unequivocally known. The Planned Parenthood legislation that did get passed just defunded state taxpayer funding of Planned Parenthood. It didn't address federal funding of Planned Parenthood. That revenue stream is still going to be going into it. It's not something I want, but that's the reality that's still going to be going on.
David?
I believe that there was a huge mistake on I'm a pro-life legislator. I have been. I'm on the board of Iowans for Life, which is basically your Catholic organization. That I'm on the board of directors there, but the pro-life organizations like Iowans Iowa Right to Life, Iowans for Life, the Family Leader, anything. There was a group, and we had a meeting down in the basement of the. Of the Capitol, on the ground floor of the Capitol. Basement sounds just too much like my basement, you know, which is not a place you'd like to have a meeting necessarily, but it's okay. It's not that bad. It's just full of junk. Anyway, there was a meeting of, and there was an agreement among everyone that there are two bills that need to move. Is no more state money to abortion providers, and life begins at conception. The statement's made that life begins at conception. But there were so many so-called pro-life bills running around rampant in the Capitol that we lost our focus. We didn't remember what we all agreed to at the beginning, and so that bill got lost, the life at conception bill. Which I saw as basically a statement that we could build off of. And I know there's disagreement. I know it's a hard issue, very emotional issue. It is for me, and I know it is for the three of us, each one in our own way. And, you know, so what happens from here, I don't know. But I thought that there were some flaws in the 20-week bill. And there are. There are some flaws there. But we weren't able to correct those and have voted for it. So we'll see what happens next session.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I have been talking with three Northwest Iowa legislators about the past session, the one that just finished last week. Republican Jim Carlin of Sioux City. Thank you, Jim, for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
It was good. And Tim Cassina, thank you as well, Democrat.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And David Johnson, independent.
Thank you for
Cheaton.
The invitation. I'll come back again.
Oh, it's fun.
If I'm invited.
Yes. Chris Hall also wanted to be here. Rick Bertrand could not be here either, the Republican state senator. Thanks so much for everyone for listening. And if you have not checked in with us yet and pledge your support, give us a call at 276-3690 to keep The Exchange on the air. Thanks so much.